We present Anonymous with Gordon Ridout as the man.
People never give you what you want, but they won't quit bugging you either. You'd think they might leave me in peace, here, of all places, but they don't. Instead, they keep sending me pictures of myself that they've cut out of the papers. Most of them add a footnote with the suggestion that I'm not going to heaven when I die, and say that that's a good idea on the whole. And there are people who send me letters in a charming shade of green ink that say if I'm ever released, they're going to chop off various bits and bobs of my anatomy and hold them up for me to admire. Funny thing is, they keep forgetting to put their names to them. Well, now I feel like writing a letter of my own. I'm not sure who it's to right at the moment, but Dr. Robertson said it might be good for me, and he's lent me a nice wedge of Basil and Bond and a pencil. So let's go. Well, I used to go to this book group. I know that sounds a bit sad, but it was just for a laugh, really. It all happened because Maria, one of the women I used to work with, spotted me reading one lunch break. Henry James, would you believe? Not that I think he's up to much, old Henry, if you ask me, a bit short on car chases. But anyway, Maria comes up to me and asks how I like the book. I was about to tell her what I thought, when she said it was her favourite one of his. So straight away, I tell her I think it's great too, how the central character's consciousness is refracted through layers of irony or some guff like that. Then she invites me to this book group she's in. I put my hands behind my back so she can't see them shaking. She said it was miles away from where I lived, but she could give me a lift back in her car. I didn't trust myself to speak, so I simply nod and smile like someone's just cut my throat. Now, the kingpin of this little literary salon was Chester, who was, as he put it, head honcho in accounts. Chester. You could always see the yachting insignia on the top pocket of his blazer, you know the type. He was always hogging the attention, talking all the time, talking rubbish too. And anyway, the only reason he started the group was to make eyes at all the women. Please. I don't mind people having a bit of fun, but there was just something about the way he did it, like a cricket rubbing its back legs together. So, I turn up every month in his hideous front lounge. He's got pictures of his grandkids all along the mantelpiece, stuck in silver frames. It looks like Death Row at junior high, which Chester would probably think was a fab idea. So anyway, the fun really started one time after I'd been going there a few months. Chester always picked the books, and then he always hated them. The book we were mangling that time was some tripe about this serial killer who was also a wine grower and a ballet critic for The Independent. It seems he leaves his victims in unusual shapes that the feisty female pathologist heroine eventually realises are Greek letters spelling out a prophecy of the coming of the beast in the Book of Revelations. Now, Chester's doing his usual chat about how overrated the book is, and eyeing up talent, which, to be honest, isn't much. Except for Maria, but she definitely wasn't interested. Anyway, usually, Chester likes to mouth off, uninterrupted. Only tonight, things go a bit wrong. Because Keith is there, and it turns out he likes the book. Keith is the sort who's embittered at being thrown out of librarian college. Bad teeth, smorgasbord breath, dandruff epaulets on his padded shoulders. Not good news. But this evening, Keith suddenly gets snotty and says that Chester is nothing but an elitist snob. Now I just sit back and watch the fun. Chester, you can see, is on the defensive and not liking it. No one's going to accuse him of being an intellectual. To be honest, I don't think many people have. So Chester calls out reinforcements and gets the ladies to back him up. Well, Chester's wife is there, Bridget, and she knows what he's about. She's a lot younger than he is, and not so bad all in all, in a has-lots-of-cats-and-makes-her-own-pottery kind of way. So why she's hitched to him is anybody's guess. Suddenly, her face crumples, and she slips out of the room. So off I go, into the kitchen, where Bridget's bent over the sink, having a good cry, and I'm like, what's the matter? And she's like, Chester's at it again. She does a bit more crying, but this time it's on my shoulder. Then I kiss her, like I'm kissing the tears away. Bingo. Soon, it's meetings for coffee together and having understanding little chats, and then, before the month is out, we're upstairs at her place doing some corrective training on the mattress. I go home, well satisfied, having done my good deed for the day. So a few weeks later, there's a ring on my doorbell. I check from behind the curtains and see Chester standing there. Oops, thinks I. This is where I exit stage left. After all, Bridget might have spilled the beans, especially as I've forgotten to answer any of her calls recently. But he sees me at the window, so there's nothing else for it but to open up and act innocent. When I open the door, however, Chester just invites himself in, plonks himself down on the sofa, and finds a half-empty bottle of vodka on the cushion. He waves it at me, inviting me to get a glass. I can't find one, so he drinks it out of a teacup. He says, "Chin chin," and knocks it back. Then he leans forward, confidentially, and tells me he feels like playing away. Why I should have been interested, I didn't know, but I was obviously expected to ask, so I inquire who the lucky lady is. And he says, "Maria." I get up and close the curtain so he won't see my expression. I look back, and I see that he's trying to twinkle roguishly. Get this. He wants me to put in a good word for him to Maria, who is, and I quote, "desperate," as her boyfriend is away for 6 months on a field trip or something. The gospel according to Chester, at any rate. In return for said favour, he will drop a word in the right ear about me at the next middle management meeting. I might get a productivity bonus. I say, "Sure," not being one to put people's noses out of joint if I can help it. I smile and offer him another drink. Of course, when he's in the gents, I nip outside and, somehow or other, the brakes of his Renault Megane accidentally get bled. Silly me. Was my face red when I heard the next day that Chester's car had gone off the road and he'd been involved in a teensy bit of a fatal accident? I show up at the funeral, wondering if Maria would be there, but she's not. Bridget is there, of course, but she doesn't talk to me. Okay, fine. As they close the curtains and send him off to be toasted, they play Schubert. Yeah, he ever listened to it in his life. Wham's about as cultured as he ever got. But I suppose you can't commit a body to the flames while you're playing Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go. I don't want a funeral. Burn me up and throw me away. Don't dump me anywhere romantic either, off a cliff or in a stream. No family or any music or anything like that. No priest either. Just send a civil servant out one Tuesday morning, carrying my remains in an old baked bean tin. Get him to empty it off a motorway bridge. The ashes would float down and get churned by the passing traffic. No one would care. No one would notice. And I'd be forgotten forever. It'd be an excuse for the guy to get out of the office. He could drop the empty can in a bin and walk back through the centre of town and see the tulips in bloom in the park and stop for a cup of coffee. He could get on expenses. Then he'd come back, flirt with a girl he fancied at the photocopier, and never have to give a curse. He'd be the only guy I ever did anything for. So, I assume that's the end of the adventure. But wait. Tune in for next week's exciting episode. The book group was on hold after Chester had so inconsiderately handed in his lunch pail. But a week or so later, there's a ding-dong on my bell. I'd been meaning to have it disconnected, but I never got round to it. I open the door, and there's Keith, of all people. I have my arm up on the doorpost, but he's able to slip past me, pretending I'm just kidding, keeping him out, and he wafts into my lounge, picking his way over the rubbish. I guess the place was running to seed a bit by then. I go into the kitchen and get a couple of cans, which are pretty warm as the fridge had packed up some while ago. When I get back, Keith is over by the mantelpiece, where there's a picture of Maria. I found it in her bag one time. Her boyfriend used to be standing next to her, but that part got lost. Anyway, as I join him, Keith waves the picture of Maria in my face, as if he had the right to touch it, and remarks that she's a bit of all right, and tells me that he's thinking of moving in on her now that that old bore Chester's out of the way. He actually thought... No. No one could. I mean, sorry, Keith, but you had what could best be called a happy-go-lucky attitude to bodily hygiene, if not a stranger to the bathtub. You're not exactly on first-name terms, either. Fair play. Anyone who looked like Keith wouldn't want to see themselves naked that often. The reason he bothered me is that Maria lives with her mother, and Keith, amazingly, doesn't live alone either. So they would need to use my house, and would I please oblige, and tidy up a bit as well. I smile and offer him another drink. He gurgles down a couple of cans, and then asks for the what's it. That's what he actually called it, the what's it, and I pointed the way. Then I went out into the shed, got something, then walked upstairs, and waited for Keith on the landing. When he came out, I helped him downstairs. Nobody ever made it down those stairs so fast. Well, what to do? Keith was lying on the floor, and he wasn't going to get up by himself. I put the hammer down and pondered the situation. Keith was already stinking the place out. What would he be like in 5 or 6 hours? Probably an improvement, but even so I couldn't chance it. It's amazing the uses a wheelbarrow can be put to when you need it. I waited till it got dark, giving myself the odd spot of lubrication to keep me going. Then I found the keys to his car in his wallet, so I was able to give him a lift back. Sorry, Keith, old sport. I like plenty of leg room in the front. Any chance you'll ride in the boot? Certainly, Richard, old bean. Anything for you. Why, thanks, Keith, old pal. You're a trooper. I knew where Keith lived, as he'd once inveigled Maria into giving him a lift back along with me while his car was in dock, being fumigated, probably. I drove up the back alley, ooh, matron, and helped Keith up the garden path. I must have been in a silly mood, because I saw a deck chair propped against his garden shed. I just couldn't resist it. I made him sit in it and put one of my empty cans in his hand. It seemed like a laugh at the time. Just as I finish, a light goes on in the house. Keith's wife, I guess. Time I wasn't here, thought I, and hightailed it out of there. I walked home feeling oddly depressed. Next evening, I was settling in for the night when there was a knock on the door. The bell wasn't working anymore. I'd taken out the battery. I ignored the noise and finished what I was doing. They knocked again. Then they beat the door in and cut me down from the light fitting. It was Her Majesty's Constabulary, and they laid me on the floor and saw that I was out of breath, so a copper lent me some of his. When they were sure I was wide awake again, they invited me to come on back to their place. Well, I wasn't doing anything, so I went. After a couple of months, I popped in to see a dear old judge who recommended that I go to this quiet little spot by the sea. It's nice. I think I'll stick around for a while. I get to help out in the kitchens every Thursday, and what I don't know about packet raspberry blancmange isn't worth knowing. I see in the paper that your boyfriend is back, and now you two are off on your honeymoon. You know he's not worthy of you. You know it. Maria? So it's you I'm writing this letter to. All I wanted was some peace. I never expected to be with you, of course, never dreamed. Just next door would have been enough. Hearing you walk into your kitchen, or maybe having the TV on, or listening to a CD. If I timed it right, our hands can touch when we're putting on our seatbelt. That's as near as I'll ever get. More than I deserve, really. Forget me. I won't send this letter. I'll look out of my window and see the planes glinting as they fly over. Maybe you're on one of them. And if you looked out of your window, you'd see this square building with walls around it. Don't look down here. Stare out at the sun on the sea. Even if I'm out in the courtyard, you won't see the infinitely small man beneath you, tearing up some paper.
In Anonymous, Gordon Ridout played The Man. The play was written and directed by Ben Francis.